Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be joined again today by Josh Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project. Top of the final week of the session morning.
Oh, I'm so excited. Kids are coming out of school. Session's ending. It's going to be wild. Right. I can't wait.
You can smell summer.
I can smell summer everywhere.
And it's the heat and the garbage. No.
Definitely the heat.
Okay. So Sunny Die is a week away. Basically, it's both a grind in the legislature right now and in some ways just completely nuts.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, lots of people walking around going, I can't wait for this to end. I hate these people.
Right.
Or on the other hand, you know, having irrational love for people that have helped them,
yeah,
you know, that is sometimes surprising. Like, no, you know, that person is surprisingly nice. What do they do for you? So there's a lot of that going on. So, you know, I kind of have in my notes, I thought we'd take stock. We're not really taking stock so much. It's just kind of this check-in at the moment of, you know, we were talking about this yesterday and what we might do. And, you know, there is this sense that, you know, it was smart for us to do the podcast, I think, to pat ourselves on the back on uncertainty a few weeks ago.
Right.
Because that's basically been the thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Since then. I mean, it's been – now, you know, and as I was thinking, and maybe at the end we'll talk about the things that are a little less uncertain or some things that are meeting expectations. But, you know, in terms of where we are, in terms of the calendar in the House, anything that's not passed on second reading Tuesday, which is today as we record, or on third reading on Wednesday, basically dead.
Right.
You know, other than so we're seeing a lot of the expected chubbing from Democrats, lots of points of order. And I think we've talked about this recently in here. I mean, it's been a very it's been a big session for points of order. I mean, look, points of order, you know, I mean, you know, you don't think about points of order when the legislature's not in session.
Oh, it's all I
and
think
then
about.
It happens and everyone's all, oh, it's a poo, you know, et cetera, on social media. But, you know, there has been a kind of distinct feel to it this time, I think. Whether that's empirically verifiable or not, we'll see when the session's over, hopefully.
Maybe we'll take a look. Kind of curious.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we're seeing the expected delay tactics and the groaning and complaining while this is going on.
Right.
There is the, you know, we are at the point where, you know, decorum falters.
I love this part.
And we've seen, you know, some both singular and collective examples of that.
I just love the shift from, you know, the back mic of, you know, will the gentleman or gentlemate lady yield for some questions? And of course I yield to, will the gentleman, no.
Yeah, right.
Not now. Not while I'm laying this out. I mean, with the dagger stare.
Yeah, the occasional lapsing into first names, you know, things like this. Yeah, very funny clip from the Senate. We haven't even talked about this from, I think it was from yesterday of, you know, Senator Eckhart.
Yeah.
Sarah Eckhart, you know, first sort of asking, you know, about wanting to ask a question of a member using, you know, I think she was asking Senator Creighton a question and said Senator Betancourt and the lieutenant governor corrected her. Said, you mean Senator Creighton? Said, what did I say? You know, oh, Senator Betancourt. Oh, yeah. Well, and she's, well, I'm still mad at Paul. And then they kind of went. So, you know, those moments that that humanize our legislators, shall we say.
That's great.
I think that's a fair way of putting it. But yeah, and lots of, you know, particularly in the House, a lot more exhortation and background noise and crowd response,
right.
I think is a good way of putting it.
A lot of grumbling from the peanut gallery.
Yes, often like a laugh track of sorts. Now, so let's, you know, so where are we to some degree? A little spot check. On the proverbial only thing the legislature has to do, the budget, that actually seems not too bad, right? There's been basic agreement from the two chambers on the overall amount almost from the beginning. They are sending signals that they have worked out final agreements on the vast majority of that. That even goes back a week, couple of weeks by now. Mm-hmm. There's just, you know, a couple of big things pending that are going to have some, you know, they're going to have to slot some numbers in, particularly property taxes in and the grid, both of which we'll talk about. So let's get to that. So three big issues still not resolved in the sense that, you know, there's not consensus between the House and Senate and varying degrees of disagreement. And that'd be in property tax relief, power grid reform, and education. And the education kind of has two pieces, right? The overall kind of spending piece and the piece that's attached to tax reform, but then also school choice and educational savings accounts, or school choice slash educational savings accounts. And those were actually combined in the last couple days in a way we'll talk about. So, you know, let's talk about this, I think, in order of the priority assigned them by Texans in our last poll.
Right. So the grid was, as we've sort of pointed out multiple times here, was at the top of our list when we sort of looked at the priorities of the lieutenant governor, the speaker, and even a few of the minority parties, you know, key priorities here. And ask people, as voters, how important it was for the legislature to accomplish each of these areas. The thing that ran to the top was, of course, improving reliability of the electric grid. And I think, you know, you and I have talked about this a lot. We've written about it a lot. I mean, I think the one thing to point out here is, for this podcast audience, is just, you know, while it's sort of been taken kind of as Democratic grumblings in the sort of the wake of the last election cycle, you know, in terms of concerns about the grid, this idea if you keep talking about the grid, it's just political, it doesn't mean anything. It's like,
yeah,
I don't think that's really what we're seeing. Ultimately, that was a very visceral experience, and the data is still bearing that out. Voters are still concerned about the reliability of the grid, no doubt. Not that a lot of them are paying attention, but when the state came out and said, hey, by the way, this summer, you know, we might have more need than we have capacity. You know, it's not, you know, at least for some voters, that is going to, you know, recharge these ideas about, okay.
It got a lot of coverage, but it was also, look, that was also, I mean, that wasn't a random person saying that. That was, you know, gubernatorial appointees delivering that message. Not to put too sharp a point on, not to put a sharp point on it at all. So that was, you know, I mean, that statement, and I'm not questioning the veracity of it, but it was definitely meant, you know, to drop a little bit, you know, as if we needed a little more catalyzing, you know, force into the, a little bit more of a catalyst into the legislative chamber at that point when that happened.
Yeah. Well, so I'd say that's also that little statement, again, the point we're making here is, you know, to the extent that an appointee went out and made the statement, there's no doubt that the executive branch was not behind this appointee going out and making the statement, which to those who would still say, hey, the grid is not really an issue— well, I think this kind of flies in the face of that because essentially, you know, the governor and his team are stepping in and saying, hey, this might be an issue if you don't do something.
And you know, to be, you know, specific about it, the numbers that were provided for that in terms of the shortfall of available wattage versus, you know, anticipated demand, you know, did not include renewables. Right.
Well, they can't be trusted,
and
right?
So, right. I mean, and that's the point. So, let's
see.
You have to take that, you know, with a grain of salt, but it's telling, right? It tells us something that we've talked about in here in terms of the, you know, one of the subtexts of this, it's not even a subtext, one of the elements of this discussion of fixing the grid has been the push to reset, if you will, the subsidy balance, the status accorded, the investment in renewables.
That's a good way to put that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right.
That's a very fair way to put it.
I mean, you
know,
well, look, and for the people on both sides, they would say, well, there's a difference, but I think it's a fair general description of what's going on here.
Yeah, and if I were to go back and make a less fair description, I would say, you know, there's still some kicking of the renewables going on because that was, you know, ultimately, there's, you know, we're still in the, I mean, to the extent that this is still an issue on voters' mind, you can still see the long tail of, like, where can we put blame?
Right.
And that's still out there, right? I mean, ultimately, that's still part of the narrative and it's part of the story.
Well, and let's, you know, look, the novelist Martin Amis died this week. Uh-huh. And my excellent wife, Shaggy Dog story that I won't go into. We were at a Texas Book Festival dinner a few years ago, and we wound up sitting with Martin Amis, which I love.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, because I like the guy. You know, he was a very bad boy. He was a very bad boy.
Yeah, I read some of his bad boy stuff.
And he was a very bad boy that night. He went up and told some very off-color jokes during the speech that the I think that the leadership of the book festival still remembers. I made a social faux pas mentioning this not long ago with the person who was the head of the book festival at that time. She was not amused. She was still not amused several years later. Point being, you know, one of the things Martin Amis, my wife sent me a quote from Martin Amis about avoiding not only cliches, but cliched language that is out in circulation.
The war against cliche, I believe.
Right. And that was really good. I'll send it to you, and who knows, maybe I'll even link it. But I think that, you know, as we look at what is going on with renewables, you know, a lot of cliches floating around this that the chief one that I was thinking of that led to that digression is never let a good crisis go to waste. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, part of what's going on with renewables here.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people that have been bristling about this for a long time in terms of federal subsidies, in terms of climate skepticism, mm-hmm. a lot of things that are really merged here. And while, you know, there are people that are here, as Chairman Hunter pointed out yesterday, which we will get to, that are interested in money, there is also, and this is about money too, but there's also kind of the axe to grind about renewable energy here and climate change that is really coming to the floor, although it's interesting how little people are explicitly talking about climate change in this and really more about the economics of it. So, you know, I think we don't necessarily have to go into all the details that are going on here. But, you know, the two chambers are pretty close.
Yeah, it seems like
given the complexity, given the lobby free-for-all that this has been. Right. And I think we talked about this a few weeks ago. I think I'd gone to a late-night hearing on one of the earlier instantiations of this bill. It was probably SB 7, but it may have been the substitute at the time. And, you know, the turnout in, you know, all branches of the even energy-related lobby was pretty impressive, you know.
Right.
Standing room only at
overflow,
you know,
room, I think,
at a little
right,
10, so. Yeah, at a 10:30 p.m. hearing. But this all did come to a head yesterday. So yesterday the House passed the current version of HB 7. And if you weren't watching, State Affairs Chairman Todd Hunter, who has been at the front of this in the House, gave a real barn burner of a speech to introduce the bill and then to defend it. And there's a lot in that speech. So, you know, you can find that in the archive. It's in part one of the video of the floor, from yesterday, which would be May 22nd. So SB has a lot of stuff in it. Maybe we should give a quick review of what's in there.
Yeah. So SB 7 would basically, we're not, you know, and this is real. I mean, like, I'm gonna tell you, this is meant for, if you're listening to this and you really know what's going on, I'm not trying to like educate you. This is for
As in last week, you know, this is not, we're not policy guys per se.
This is for the relatively normal among you
right.
who are listening to this, right? So essentially they would require renewable generators like wind and solar to supplement their operations with backup power during intermittency phase. And this is this whole idea. A lot of talk about dispatchable power during, you know, again, times of, you know, peak demand, things like that.
Yeah.
It would also establish this sort of other service product called dispatchable reliability reserve service. And essentially, this is just emergency generation when the grid approaches or reaches capacity. And this is sort of, you know, this is expensive. This is pretty expensive. I think they estimate this will be cost about $4 billion per year to be able to provide this service. And then the other sort of big piece of this is
That buttresses that.
Yeah,
right.
Is the performance credit mechanism, the PCM, which, you know, if you've been paying any attention to this, you'll hear this being thrown around a lot.
The two words have been dispatchable and PCM.
Right. And this is essentially a way to incentivize the power generators to create additional, you know, generation capacity for
these peak times of peak demand. So it comes up with, I think, a formula for paying them, you know, if they build this and tap into it.
And a big part of, you know, I think the Chairman Hunter's speech was about, you know, how much money are we going to commit to these incentives? Are we going to put a cap on it? I mean, he clearly is saying, yes, we are going to put a cap on this. But to the extent that, you know, a lot of the interests out there are either arguing for a higher cap or no cap, that was like a big part of the
crux. And the politics of that go back pretty far. The original cap in this bill was $500 million that was, I believe, came out of a consultant report that ERCOT had that was that was sort of solicited and was supposed to guide this through ERCOT. And there's been a lot of talk about, you know, whether that from the beginning, where that $500 million number came from, whether it was enough, whether a cap was a good idea. There have been a lot of, you know, probably some of the people that Chairman Hunter has been complaining about saying that the cap was too artificial. It was actually ultimately a disincentive given the level of investment required, et cetera. Now, Chairman Hunter not buying any of that. And I think in a lot of ways, that $500 million number was something that, you know, was arrived at as kind of a, oh, that's what you say? Even if you can't really explain it, that's fine. That's where we're going to start. And so they've moved up. And you know, we should move on to a couple more issues. But, I can't urge people strongly enough to go look at Chairman Hunter's layout.
And I just want to say, like, it's a good example of where we are in the process, that this is an area where we'd say, you know, they're pretty close.
Yeah.
Right. You know, because ultimately, I mean, one of the things I think at the outset was, you know, it wasn't clear what the mechanisms would be, what constellation of mechanisms, what kind of money they were going to put into it, you know, what kind of new requirements. And so the fact that you're kind of at this point, you say, well, these are the things that in and of itself is a pretty heavy lift to get here. And now it's kind of a little bit of, you know, again, various hurt feelings and other pieces.
Well, and there are safety valves out there. So, for example, I mean, the Senate Business and Commerce met and they've been ground zero for this legislation on the Senate side under Chairman Schwertner. And what they did was they last night met and heard several amendments. I had a list and I didn't bring it with me, but it's, you know, double figures of amendments that are lettered to meet the House requirement that those amendments be pre-heard. So there, you know, and the preparation there is that those are amendments that are prepared for the sunset bill. And so on, I believe, the PUC, and it might be ERCOT, actually. And we'll have to go and correct that at some point. I don't know. We won't do a NOVA, but I'll look it up and we'll put it in the podcast, in the post on the podcast. But that is, you know, sort of a preparation in case some of this falls apart. Some pieces of legislation that people have been trying to pass that haven't made it in, other provisions they want to make sure don't get left out. So, you know, the negotiation is still going on and there's a lot of pieces on the board. But I think the general sense is, you know, look, per our polling, I think there's a sense that they have to do something on this and that they're going to get it done. Which brings us to another, to the next item on our list, which had a lot to, you know, which there's been a lot of talk about, and in which they are not quite as close, I don't think. Certainly not process-wise and substance-wise, I don't think so either, and that's property taxes.
Yeah, I mean, it's really remarkable when you go through the list of the big issues that are still outstanding. They actually were, in some respects, especially at the top here, the biggest issues for voters. I mean, when we said, what do they need to accomplish? You know, number two was a reduction in property taxes. And so that was 41% of Texans said it was extremely important for the legislature to do this. It's the second highest. 68% of Texans and more than two-thirds said it was either extremely or very important. So this was certainly on voters' minds going into this. Now, we talked about this a lot last week and in some detail.
Right. And the proposal we talked about last week has now been passed. You know, we recorded on Tuesday or Wednesday last week. On Friday, the House passed the bill that we talked about, which, you know, sort of does both, you know, munges both proposals in the House and the Senate together, about which there had been very harsh words exchanged earlier in the session. And then some, and again, we talked about a lot, the bill would raise the homestead exemption to 100,000, which is, you know, 30,000 above what was in the Senate. Raising of the bill to raise the homestead exemption also includes the 5% appraisal cap for all real property, not just homesteads, which is the core of the House proposal, with some other, you know, elements in terms of school financing. And as far as I'm aware, there's been no formal response from the Senate, but one does get the sense that there are discussions going on. There was kind of a photo op earlier in the week where there – a couple of photo ops where there had been a meeting between the big three and then this handshake on the Senate dais between the speaker and the lieutenant governor. Though if you look at that photo, it's a very captionable moment in terms of facial expression and – even if you zoom in on the handshake, you know, I read it as like Patrick's given Phelan kind of he jumped on the handshake grip and got the better grip first. Now, that could be totally wrong, but if you look very closely at finger placement in that photo, it looks to me like Patrick did the "I'm jumping in there and grabbing your hand," as we, you know, have these kind of, you know, funny expressions on her face, one of which is kind of a death's head grin, et cetera. So property taxes still very much out there. Another thing that, you know, that, I mean, this is something where I think if this falls apart, this is something the governor will call them back on immediately because of the runway you need to implement these tax reductions, right? Yeah. So you've got to get, if you're going to do this, you got to get it done. If this breaks down, they're coming back, and they're coming back sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I mean, you just figure they're just going to continue, you know, they're just going to have to continue on this. I mean, the thing is, it'd be interesting to see what happens with that in the sense that, you know, one of the big pieces of the budget that remains outstanding, of course, is how they're going to deal with this, the property tax reduction, and then the impact that it has on public education. And so that's sort of sitting out there in the budget. So then, I mean, and this is just a question, maybe you know, but I mean, if this were to fall through, you know, would they just basically pass a budget without it and then come back and deal with it? Or would they just hold the whole budget and say, we're just going to have to deal with this whole thing at once? I don't know. But I mean, the thing about
I think if the expectation is that they were going to come, you know, don't know, and that's probably going to be pretty conditional, you know.
I mean, I think the thing is, this is another one of those things where, you know, we were kind of joking, observing last week that by the House going and saying, you know, oh, well, you know, you want to do a 70,000 home segment? Well, you know, we want to do 100.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a certain part of that that's a little bit of like, you know, in the moment, that's a little bit of a middle finger. You know?
Yeah, it was definitely I think we called it a jab. I called it a jab last
year. Yeah, because ultimately when you leave, regardless of what happens, you know, the House is going to be able to say, and House members are going to say, hey, look, you know, we passed the biggest property tax cut.
Right.
You know, we just ultimately, when we negotiated with the Senate, we had to lower it. So, I mean, they're already in that position. But the other side of this is to say, okay, you know, you get the short point, whatever. But the other way to look at this, say, okay, but, you know, the House was not for an increase in the homestead exemption until they did this. And what this says is that it's on the table.
Yeah, right.
And that's the point. So even though it feels like there's still this jabbing going on, I mean, they've actually moved significantly closer to each other simply by the House acknowledging the Senate's main vehicle here.
Right.
So they're going to get something done. They have to.
Okay, so if we go back for a moment to our ranking from the last poll, the next issue I want to talk about, you know, that is very unresolved is vouchers or savings accounts, educational savings accounts, et cetera. School safety was actually the third topic in between there, or third highest in between there. And that bill is pretty much on the road. I mean, they're going to conference, but I don't think that, you know, I'm not getting any signs that they're not going to be able to iron out. The differences are not huge. There's some things that that I think different actors want to do in the midst of this.
Yeah.
And I think this is, you know, this is pretty much going to be get passed.
It seems to be down to some, you know, reasonably minor details. You know, I mean, ultimately the idea is they're trying to beef up security on school campuses. The question is who's going to be that security? You know, they want to put some money into hardening schools and providing safety. The question is, how much?
Right.
You know, who gets it? Who doesn't?
And inevitably, when you're doing things like this, you know, I mean, you've made this point about the expenditures on schools. It's always expensive.
Yeah.
But also, you know, the web of authority over the implementation of all this stuff is really extensive, and that I think there's still some issues to be worked out.
Well, and that's the other big piece of this, which is basically requiring that every school and school district have, you know, sort of these active, you know, active shooter plans in place.
Right.
Which, yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think came out of Uvalde and kind of came out the introspection on all that I think has not really been, I don't know, I think it's really gotten less attention probably than it should, is how few campuses actually have active shooter plans in place.
Right.
Now, on the one hand, I mean, I could go on about this in various ways to think about it. It's not important, you know, what I think about it in this sense. But ultimately, like, these are the three kind of pieces of the stool. They all seem to kind of agree that these are the things that are going to happen. You know, they're going to use sticks, not carrots, to make sure that they get those active shooter plans in place. But, I mean, the thing about this is, you know, I mean, to the extent that there's any sort of debate going on right now, as far as I can tell, it's whether or not, like, mental health is part of this or not.
Well, there's some other things involved, too.
And they're and it seems like they're saying mental health is not going to be part of this piece of it. But that's kind of the whole point here is, to my mind.
I think the quote du jour this week was, you know, we don't want schools to be the delivery system for mental health.
Which I thought was an interesting perspective.
Yeah.
Given that that's where the kids are all day. And it is actually the primary provider of most services to children in the state. So, I mean, it's not a crazy vehicle for that kind of thing, just to throw that out there. But, I mean, this is one of those things, again, you know, this is a problem that's so big. It's so amorphous. I mean, it's so big. And depending on who you ask, what is going to look like a solution on school safety is going to be different. But given that what we know about, you know, again, public opinions towards gun violence and school violence and that, those sorts of issues, we know that Republican voters in particular are going to be looking at, you know, sort of these factors that are kind of far beyond the school walls, parenting,
right,
things like that, like violence and popular culture. And the things that can be, you know, I think attacked head on are these sorts of things, which are basically, can you make the schools safer?
Right.
Can you put up more walls, more doors? Can you put people there with guns? And, you know, again, whether that's effective or not, or whether they're spending enough money on that is honestly.
Right. And that is one of the outstanding issues, I think, is, you know, security provisions.
Well, this is,
et cetera.
And this is the problem with all these kinds of things. You know, I mean, there's something about this when, you know, I had a friend once who talked about this in terms of the context of Benghazi, right? And let's go blast from the past. But he's saying, you know, when all these issues came up where the security staff in Benghazi said, oh, you know, we need more security here. We need more security here. And that was sort of shown as a smoking gun as to, you know, sort of their issue not being taken care of. And my friend, who studies foreign policy, said, yeah, you know, you should kind of go and ask yourself, how many foreign embassies do you think request additional security?
Right.
They probably all do. Most of them do in most cases, and certainly most do in any sort of area with any sort of conflict or issue. So to sort of say, well, this one didn't get it and that's the cause of this, it's like, and there's sort of a similar thing here to my mind, you know, in the sense
Well, look,
that,
I mean,
you know,
this does go back to, you know, the broader point that we beat to death here to some degree. But, you know, they're, you know, given the governing majority in the state being, you know, Republican and not going anywhere, given what we know about Republican public opinion, you know, there's a real – I think there's a real sort of impulse to do something, and it's not going to be guns.
Right.
And this is something that they are, I think, intent on delivering – given the framework, and we shouldn't leave out the fact that it's, you know, we're right here on the year anniversary of the shooting at Robb Elementary in Uvalde. Media saturation, I mean, there was a – I didn't see it, but there's a documentary on Sunday night on CNN that revisited the whole thing and, you know, included, I think, some new footage and new interviews with parents and survivors. Frontline's doing a documentary next that will air – next week, Tuesday, I think, in most markets in Texas. So this is also like the alignment of that with the end of the session. You know, I mean, it's not determinative, but it's going to,
well, not to be
bring like, it back into people's – the forefront of people's minds.
Yeah, not to be like, you know, too cynical here, but I mean the point I want to make is just, you know, the legislature is not going to get any credit for the mass shootings that don't happen.
Right.
Ultimately, they get blame, right, if another school shooting happens. But the reality is like –
if they can't avoid it.
They'll get blame. I mean, I think they'll be blamed, I mean, honestly, if there's another school shooting in Texas regardless. I mean, this is kind of part of the dynamics that we see now. But the point is, you know, for every potential school shooter that goes in after this is, you know, too many locks or whatever.
Where they catch somebody trying to get in and they can't or
Well, even that like I would that. Say is a little bit different. But I would just say the idea that this becomes a deterrent or something to these sorts of events, ultimately they actually get no political credit for that. I'm not saying that that's a reason not to go full in on it, but it does lead to this idea of like, yeah, we can invest all the money in this that we want to, and we're still not actually going to get credit for that unless there are just no school shootings and nobody can guarantee that.
Right.
And so I think that in some ways that creates, you know, a natural sort of perverse incentive to not go overboard here. Nobody's saying, hey, you know what? Let's spend $15 billion of the surplus and make sure these schools are the safest places in the state of Texas, because they could. But that's not really on the table because you don't really get credit for that.
And you can't cut property taxes.
And you can't cut property taxes that way.
Or, you know, have a – well, never mind. Okay. So, you know, so then finally, speaking of schools in a very different vein, vouchers. Right. Now, this is something that is – you know, it seems very unlikely to pass, though they're making another stab at it in the last couple of days. And school safety, again, I mean, is there vouchers, you know, not something that scored high on the importance scale, but something that has been, you know, very prominent on the priority list of the lieutenant governor and the governor. We've talked about this a lot. After the House decided to, you know, kill its watered down version after the governor just said it wasn't good enough and he was going to veto it, the Senate has now tacked a significantly larger voucher program onto Ken King's, the Ken King authored HB 100, which was the House bill that would increase teacher salaries and do some other things in the school finance space, you know, had some, I believe, new money involved in that. Now, what the House Education Committee did this week was tacked another voucher bill onto that. Now, this would seem to have dim prospects in the House, but it is the play that we've been waiting for all along.
It's the question.
Right. I mean, we've been waiting for this. You know, can rural, you know, that boils down to, can you buy a few votes from rural Republicans by pressuring them into putting just enough money that their local districts say, well, we can live with this?
It's so remarkable the way the politics of this has shifted to something that's just become so distributive, right? Because before, the issue was, you know, we see this in the data, you know, it's not as though there weren't, you know, clear concerns among Republican voters about the public education system, but they were more having to do with, you know, basically avenues for parental involvement and curriculum concerns.
Yeah, and we should say standalone support for school vouchers, even among rural people. It was divided, but it was not, you know.
Yeah, that's right. But the relative weight put towards focus on vouchers versus some of these other issues, vouchers were pretty far down the list.
Yeah, yeah, and we had an item last time that said, you know, which of the following do you think will help improve public education, right?
There was that one. But in February, what we actually asked, when we were kind of looking at these different sort of broad issues out there about teacher pay and retention, about, you know, curriculum, curriculum issues, about parental rights broadly construed, vouchers, treatment of transgender children, et cetera, you know, it was curriculum concerns and basically involvement, parental rights that were at the top for Republicans, and then vouchers were pretty far down. And the issue has been all along, well, these two issues, again, parental rights especially, are big among Republicans, and we see that in the data. So that's true. And the idea was that, well, these are so big, we're going to pull vouchers across with them because it's all parental rights. I mean, even, you know, Senator Crayton said as much, basically. You know, when I talk to constituents, this is a bundle, which I got to say, I do not buy for 1 second. I'm just going to throw that out there, just as someone who studies mass opinion. Well, someone who studies opinion, it's like, oh, so you talk to a lot of voters who, like, you know, have this really strong cluster. Anyway, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever. But now, you know, having failed at doing that, it's just, I mean, this is just such old school education. It's like, what if we just attach it to a bunch of money?
Well, we talked about this. We talked about this a little bit last week in terms of the evolution of, you know, the initial argument that, you know, parental rights is now super, you know, has provided a vehicle for this, and the degree to which that has worked or not.
We've been skeptical from the beginning, but then again, I think what's funny is at this point in the process, like, okay, fine, but like, do you want to give your teachers raises?
But I would also say this, right? I mean, you know, and I've been discussing this, you know, I don't want to unpack this right now because I think I'm not sure how much I completely believe this, other than when somebody says, well, is there any hope on guns, right? And that is, when we step back, what do we know? We know that big things take a long time. They take multiple sessions. You know, this voucher, I'm sorry, this ESA bill has gotten pretty far.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, there's going to be some sense of having progressed here. You know, my guess, it's gotten, talking to people at the Capitol and in the community, I think it's gotten baked into people's general expectations that they're not going to make it this session. The governor will call a special session at a later date, probably in the fall, to revisit vouchers. So the question now is, with this tacked onto the Ken King bill, how much, assuming that this move in the Senate does not work, does it kill the entire Ken King bill? I think at this point it might.
Yeah.
I mean, it would almost have to, I think, given where we are. But I don't know. There's, you know, I'm not a legislative, you know, strategist per se. Or will they have to punt that whole ball of wax into the fall in order to preserve their maximal kind of bargaining position?
Yeah. I mean, it's been really interesting in the sense that, like, the extent to which people talk about this space with a fair amount of certainty has sort of struck me throughout the session. And even the people who are talking about it kind of shift around on. I mean, before the session started, you know, people were kind of repeating, you know, the conventional wisdom about, well, you know, vouchers are going to be dead in the House.
Right.
And, like, yes, that's technically been true, but it's been a lot closer than I think, you know, people thought in the past. And it's sitting here from the outside watching it, you know, I mean, ultimately the proponents of vouchers and the legislative and, you know, state leaders who've been pushing the voucher, you know, issue forward, the governor, the lieutenant governor especially, but also their allies, has been to, you know, in a lot of ways, try to change the calculation for some of these rural members where they see, you know, holding out against one of these things as more costly than holding the line. And they've obviously, you know, look, they haven't gotten across the finish line, but they've clearly been successful because they've changed the numbers pretty solidly on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to all the, you know, I mean, again, I think, you know, if you're kind of looking around right now, people saying, well, you know, vouchers are definitely dead. And yeah, like, you know, are they dead right now? Dead completely into
odds
the next
are
session?
Again, yeah. On life, you know, odds to violate Martin Amis's thing on life support.
Yeah. Odds are against.
Sorry, Martin.
Odds are against it. Like they're against, I mean, almost anything. But I wouldn't go out there with a huge amount of certainty and say, oh, yeah, this is definitely dead. Like, because look, you know, attach it to, you know, a big pay increase for teachers.
No, that's the point I was making earlier. That was the point I was making earlier.
Yeah,
right.
And even further, though, I mean, you know, put it in a special session where there's no other issue competing with it for space.
Yeah.
That's a different dynamic, you know? And so I don't think, you know, again, vouchers still have much on life support, but again, this whole notion of like, well, the House has already said no multiple, it's like, I mean,
people that don't, I mean, look, I had a couple rural members sort of lay this dynamic out for me, you know, like in February or March, like, yeah, votes seem pretty solid now, but they have ways of putting pressure on us that, you know, clearly some members knew would, you know, might work.
Yeah, and they might backfire too, and that's the other piece of this, so we kind of have to wait and see.
And, you know, I mean, I think if you think about the tone of Chairman Hunter's speech yesterday and, you know, the general, again, not certainly not unprecedented, but the kind of dynamic between the Senate and the House that's been really pronounced this time, there's kind of an intangible in the House that's kind of like, yeah, you know, hell with you guys.
Well, as I was saying to you before we went on, it's really remarkable how at this point in the session, that kind of like, you know, especially because of the dynamics, you know, of the last number of sessions, really since, you know, Lieutenant Governor Patrick has taken over. But this notion of like mobilizing this House muscularity, this kind of, you know, chest thumping, you know, it's, well, you know, all the damn lobbyists up there, you know, they don't run this place. And you know what else? They didn't come talk to us.
Right.
Like, it's like, okay.
which was, yeah. And you're referencing some other elements of the chairman's speech yesterday that had a funny populist kind of swagger to it for somebody who, you know, has been presiding over, you know, the most, as we've said earlier, one of the most heavily corporate lobby, you know, spasms, eruptions of corporate lobbying that we've seen in a long time. But nonetheless, I think, you know, there is a sense that that card remains to be played. But what that ultimately is going to look like, I think, is going to be very interesting. And it'll be interesting for us to poll on some of the undercurrents of that. We had all kinds of other things we could talk about. I think, you know, there's a lot of things still floating out there. Some are more resolved than others. I'm just going to hit a couple of things very quickly on, you know, state preemption of cities, the mothership of preempt, you know, the mothership bill or whatever they're calling it of preemption.
The Death Star.
The Death Star. Yes, it's much darker. That's, you know,
from it destroys the
It's the mothership planets. From the perspective of state government, you know, builders of state government power as the Death Star for cities and localities. HB 2127 that is, you know, the big preemption bill, you know, that's on its way to the governor's desk. There are several others still floating out there that are a little bit more old school and that they're more specifically targeted, including the bill that's aimed at kind of undoing Project Connect in Austin. On the trio of higher ed issues that are out there that originated in the Senate, tenure and DEI are floating around having been diluted in the House, but both have been passed and sent back to the Senate. Question about whether, you know, the lieutenant governor, I mean the Senate, are going to accept those, and that's SB 17 and SB 18. You know, the tenure bill was significantly watered down, though a lot of the higher ed community still sees danger in the kind of oversight, the increased oversight of tenured faculty that are in there. The House version on DEI created some carve-outs. I kind of suspect that that's going to be okay in the Senate, but we'll see. And they killed the, you know, what had been billed as the anti-CR by the lieutenant governors, the anti-CRT bill that made everybody at the university, you know, pinky swear not to brainwash people and persecute conservatives.
Right.
That guy, that's dead. So those are still kind of out there. The ban on gender-affirming care is headed to the governor's desk. The drag show prohibitions have been watered down, et cetera, but that's still kind of in play. That's just a few things. We should, you know, I think in terms of what it all means, I think we're, you know, we're going to, I'm going to punt that for a week. I mean, I really do think, as dramatic as it always seems at the session and all these things we've talked about, you know, if you had said to us in January, look, about the third week of May, mm-hmm. you're going to be looking at the odds being against vouchers.
Yep.
There still being a bunch of sort of talk and there being hurt feelings and a lot of, you know, big player elbow, you know, crossing, but in the end on the grid, but in the end looking like it's been a pretty good session for oil and gas.
Yep.
We would not have been surprised by that prediction. Mm-hmm. Right.
A throw and roll of the enshrinement of border security funding.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we haven't talked about border security funding, but yeah,
there's not controversial at all,
right? Not much controversy other than, you know, trying to extend the envelope in a couple of directions, right? And that they're doing a bunch on school safety, they're not quite there.
Yeah,
property tax reform, everybody wants it. You know, that's probably the thing that I think is maybe a little more. There may be a little further from disagreement right now than I might have thought back in January. But the path of that disagreement being aggravated by differences between the House and the Senate, not shocking.
Yeah, well, you know, and the other thing about that one in particular is, you know, there's something about the rhetoric around property tax reduction I think almost makes it more difficult in the sense that, you know, whenever we talk about almost anything else, like we talk about, like, you know, for example,
right.
you know, it's just a quick, you know, because it's related. You know, people have said, well, you know, why don't you give teachers this level of raise or that level of raise? And a lot of times the sort of knee-jerk response for those who don't want to do that is say, hey, look, we can't commit to an ongoing expense like that.
Yeah.
And nobody talks about property taxes as if they're not – reduction as if it's not an ongoing expense.
Right.
But ultimately, it kind of is. I mean, again, the mechanisms will matter in that in some very key ways.
Right.
But it is an ongoing expense, and I think that's one of the things that kind of sits out there with stuff like this. I mean, there is a hamstring that legislatures are doing to – the legislature does to itself in future sessions if there is an economic downturn.
Well, and I think this is probably a good time to remember – to hearken back to one of those – moments when, you know, a legislator inadvertently sort of says the truth. And, you know, in this case, it's Senator Betancourt who, you know, a couple of, you know, 6-8 weeks ago, I think somebody asked about the recurring costs and he just said, look, you know, people want this now. Yeah, that's probably right.
It's going to create a crisis.
But, you know, people want this right now. And so we're going to get it. And we'll just have to, you know, that crisis is later.
We promise it.
You know, that's a paraphrase. So don't, you know, I don't want to get slapped with a, you know, slap suitors.
You know, not to go, you know, you said sort of, you know, what does it all mean? We're going to have to wait a little bit. But it is interesting, you know, kind of when you lay it all out like that and kind of thinking about going into this session, there was this sort of, you know, if you want to, you know, when we're just sort of really kind of even a little further back from the session, thinking, you know, what kind of session is this going to be? You know, a lot of people would sort of talk about, on the one hand, the 2018 session and on the other, or the 2019 session,
right.
On the other hand, you know, the 2021 session, 2019 session really focusing on, you know, what we say, bread and butter, infrastructure.
Yeah.
In the wake of a close 2018 election, 2021, you know, going into redistricting, feeling pretty good about themselves, really, you know, very, very conservative session. And I think the question going into is, well, is it going to be more like A or B? What are we going to see? In a lot of ways, you know, this is kind of, I almost want to say it's a little bit more like A than B, actually, to my mind, which I'd say more of an infrastructure focus, but also like it's a pretty good mix of the two, right?
Right.
It's not really either one or the other. You know, we're still talking about big, big issues. We're talking about the grid. We're talking about water supply, right? We're talking about property taxes. We're talking about school safety. And if you want to, you know, look, we're talking about the border. And these are all kind of, broadly speaking, infrastructure of the state, you know, in terms of childcare, safety,
sure.
You know, is territorial sovereignty, as some people would put it. You know, and again, these sort of basic functioning. And then, of course, we're still going to ban gender affirming care for minors. We're going to see some things around the edges, which
right.
we always do.
Right.
But it's not
the anti-DEI stuff, the, you know.
But those aren't necessarily, I mean, you know, not to be dismissive, and I'm really not trying to be here, but those aren't going to be the headline policies that come out of this legislature if they do manage to move forward on the things. And again, from the leaders
right.
that they want to talk about, the thing they're going to talk about is, you know, historic investment in border security, historic investment in property tax reduction.
We did something about school safety and we secured the grid.
Historic investment in the grid.
Yeah. And, you know.
That's what, you know, and that's.
If there's other stuff still to do. I mean, and I think that's why, you know, if the property tax thing falls apart, they got to come back and do that right away. Yeah. You know, I think, you know, and we'll save this for the post. I mean, I think what's interesting, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately, although, you know, we've talked about it before, but what's a little bit almost cuts across, it's not orthogonal. That's for you, Ross Ramsey. But, you know, it's not exactly linear with, you know, parallel to all these things is, you know, the kind of the thing that stitches all of that together is this shift towards, you know, a stronger state government vis-a-vis local government, and in the longer term, the continuation of a stronger executive branch vis-a-vis the legislative branch and even the judicial branch.
We're going to come back to that.
That's the connective tissue to me that kind of – something that both of those sessions actually have in common. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that sense, this Death Star bill or whatever, the preemption issue this time – is a little bit of a binding agent for all of this. If you look at how in some of these other areas, the fallback, even in terms of school safety, the fallback is, look, we want you guys to do these things. How are we going to enforce it? Well, there's a state agency to do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. You guys all need to do this stuff, and the state agency is going to be the person overseeing that. And I think, you know, when you step back and look at the longer trajectory, you know, that is going to be, I think, that I you know, the more I think about it, we'll see what happens in the final, in this next couple days. To me, that may be the watershed takeaway from this session that transcends and binds all these other issues. And, you know, I'm not going to cram everything into that bucket, but I do think that's going to ultimately be the takeaway on that.
It's really interesting to hear you say that. I think, you know, I'll just add one thing is what I'm thinking is it's really interesting to think that, you know, the legislature – the idea that the legislature is consolidating power at the state level in a really, I think you could say, unprecedented way, probably with the preemption bill. And they're doing it in the wake of, you know, the tenures of two Texas governors who really have tried to consolidate power in the executive branch. And so, and now, you know, it's, again, you're seeing the legislative branch both, you know, push back in both directions a little bit, push back a little bit against the governor, you know, a little bit, and they'll see if they do that with the emergency power stuff. And then also back at the cities in particular, where again, you know, political competitiveness, and especially in Harris County, is leading to sort of just more Democratic control of these areas. And so there's a sort of pushback to say, you know what, the state is really, you know, and the state here, meaning the legislature, is really going to, you know, exert itself.
And I'll give the governor this on, you know, I mean, this is it's a footnote to that, but we'll give the governor this. I mean, he has ceded ground on the emergency stuff in a lot of ways and actually asked, you know, has sort of set up the legislature to do that. Now, some people like Birdwell may be going a little bit further than he'd like, but nonetheless, you know, I think they saw that coming and saw the politics of that around COVID, less so on the border. But, you know, I think they can, you know, they've already got that authority on the border. It's the emergency stuff around COVID that's been such a, you know, a magnet for all that kind of ill will. And it sort of drove his primary challenges in a lot of ways. And, you know, those, you know, the people that ran against him tried to throw the border in on that, but it didn't really work. But the COVID thing was still around there, and they've moved on that. And they've been, frankly, helped by national politics and the general sense that people don't want to talk about COVID anymore. So with that, thanks for being here, Josh. Thanks again to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. You know, we're probably going to try to add a couple of goodies. I don't want to promise because I'm not sure I can get it done. But, you know, check our blog site. If you're listening to this podcast through Spotify or Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or another platform, check our website out at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Go to the blog section. We usually try to add a couple of things that we've talked about here, whether it's graphics. I got a couple ideas for this one. So check that out. Thanks for listening. We'll be back, I suspect, maybe a day late next week. We'll probably wait for Sine Die to set in and maybe record a little bit later next week, let things settle, see where we are.
Let us recover.
See what happens, see what does. Yeah, it's, you know, well, see what happens, see what doesn't, see what the governor does.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, as we've said here, something else could happen. So thank you all for listening. We'll be back sometime next week, the point being, with another Second Reading podcast. Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.